Ready, Derek? Are we ready? Okay. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Tuesday, May 26th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. We're going to convene as a subcommittee so that we won't keep our legislative friends waiting, and I will begin by opening a public hearing on SJR 6 and a public hearing also on SJR 8. And Erin, would you briefly tell us what we are looking at?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. SJR 6 proposes amendment to Oregon Constitution to modify a maximum number of calendar days of regular sessions of Legislative Assembly, refers the proposed amendment to the 2016 general election. SJR 8 proposes amendment to Oregon Constitution to limit types of legislative measures that Legislative Assembly may enact during even-numbered year regular session unless passed by two-thirds vote of each House of the Legislative Assembly. Both these measures come to you with no revenue impact. We have not had a fiscal impact statement issued on either.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And I think we'll just take these in order, if that's okay. And we'll start with SJR 6 and ask Senator Devlin, the chief sponsor, to come forward and testify. Good afternoon, Senator Devlin, former chair of our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and other member of the committee. Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19, I'm here to testify in favor of SJR 6. My purpose here today is to begin a discussion, actually for the second time to try to begin a discussion, about improving the short session. The reality is that we need to examine the short session and see how we can improve the process. Whether that's contained in this bill or that's contained in further discussions, that's the conversation I would like us to have, and hopefully we could start today. I tried this last session and I didn't get too far. I would like to take a moment to discuss the past history of annual legislative sessions when we had biennial sessions. We all remember our long sessions that went into August. And if you think about that and how people feel like this session is long, remember what it's like to start here in January and end in August. People also remember our five special sessions around 2002. One time when I brought up an annual sessions bill before we had annual sessions, it passed in the Senate by 20 votes, 20 to 10. It's very bipartisan. There were 10 Democrats in favor, 10 Republicans in favor. Obviously, the counts are pretty straightforward. Five Republicans, no. Five Democrats, no. Discussions about session length have never been uncontroversial, whether it's switching from annual sessions to biennial sessions or adjusting the dates that we now have. We all went through our experience of trying to put in place annual sessions by calling ourselves into special sessions in 2008 and 2010, and doing everything possible to keep our long session to no more than 6 months during that period. We were successful in this. I think that's one of the reasons voters responded so favorably when the measure was referred in 2010, and during that time is when I actually chaired this committee, is when we referred that measure. That measure started out, we introduced in this committee a bill with a framework to set limits. We started with a discussion about 135 days for the long session and 45 days for the short session. Most of us thought 45 days was the minimum period of time in which we could do relatively good work. The House then changed the 135 days to 165 days for the long session. And unfortunately, to reach a compromise that we could pass that session and refer to the voters, which they ultimately approved, and I think they probably, given what how the process we'd went through, they approved this by, I think, close to a two-thirds majority. They would have probably approved either version if we'd put it before them. And we would have been much better off to have had a 45-day version of the short session. But ultimately, we ended up with 160 days for the long session and 35 days for the short session. bill before you does not expand the number of days in total. It simply increases the number of days in the short session to 45 and reduces the number of days in the long session to 150. Think about it this way. This would have guaranteed you would have been out by July 4th in this session. You're not guaranteed that right now. I submitted this bill to continue the discussion on how we can improve the short session. We made the decision to create annual sessions. It's now our responsibility, I believe, to make them more productive. And I do believe it's important that we have that discussion. Unfortunately, I think many times what we will do is complain about the short session. We will not do anything in the interim before the short session to get a better agreement on what we should be doing in the short session. And we will just go another short session and people will continue to complain. But we will not do the work necessary to make that a more productive session. One of the problems with the short session now, to be frank, there are a lot of issues. One of them is, to be honest, there are just too many bills to consider in that short a period of time. There were 266 bills in the 2014 short session. On numerous occasions, we are faced with complex bills, we must make decisions too quickly, even though legislators might not be comfortable with all components of the bill or the language in the bill. While SJR 6 would only give us a bit more time to review bills, I believe it would lead to a significant improvement. One of the reasons I believe that is the way the current process is set up in a short session, it's quite obvious that there is very little time to deliberate on bills. Bills, honestly, if they have even the slightest glitch in them, are either forced through or they die. Because of the time frames that bills have to get from one to chamber to another. And if you look at those time frames and if you added 10 days in there, I think you would have a much more deliberative process than you have now. You will hear about other proposals that are out there, some that would have to limit the session to budget only. But I would remind you that we're not actually putting forward a new budget every annual session. We are actually, in reality, only rebalancing an existing two-year budget. It would be very difficult to involve the 90 members of the legislative body in a short session if all we were actually doing was rebalancing a budget. To conclude, I'd like to repeat that I came today simply to start a discussion. If the committee chose to refer this to the floor, I think that would be wonderful. I do not know what the vote outcome would be if it went to the floor. But I would like to remind people that it was the Senate, when this was referred, that indicated that 45 days was the minimum practical time to be able to do our work in the short session. And we also indicated at the time that we could probably do the longer session in a shorter period of time than the House was willing to accept. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I urge your positive recommendation on SJR 6.
Okay, thank you, Senator Devlin. Are there any questions for Senator Devlin? Okay, I don't see any questions for you. Thank you for bringing this forward and for your testimony. And I think next we'll call Senator Betsy Johnson. We've already opened. And we already have opened a hearing on SJR 8.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, and it always delights me when Senator Devlin and I agree on something. I, too, have offered a bill with the idea of improving the short session and improving the process. And just as Devlin spoke, that this may be the beginning of a conversation. I came to the notion of annual sessions very slowly. My father had served during a time when a true citizen legislature came to Salem, did their business expeditiously, and went home. I also served in the two longest sessions in Oregon's history. But I came to the notion somewhat slowly. I realized, however, that we were tied to federal policy as well as federal pocketbook. The people's branch of government, the legislature, was largely missing in action when we met only in the odd-numbered years. years, and I had observed a temptation on the part of the e-board to begin straying heavily into policy. So I supported the notion of test-flying annual sessions in 2008 and 2010, and as Senator Devlin just testified, of course, the voters memorialized annual sessions in November of 2010. Since then, it has been my observation that issues have metastasized. They came to an apex into the 2014 session when we were taking up major policy bills, as well as bills that had failed to garner support in the 2013 long session. Bills that could not get support in 5 months were now coming into the February 2014 session looking for support in 5 weeks. SJR 8 seeks to restore some of the discipline to the short session. When I was out campaigning for annual sessions, I had interacted with my voters on the notion that we would come back in this short session to track agency performance against legislatively approved budgets, make technical corrections to bills from the previous long session where we had actually made errors or new information had come to light, dealing with true emergencies such as conflagration, and the notion of introducing concepts for the next long session. Senator Devlin makes a good point that a short session couldn't intrigue all 90 members if we were just dealing with budget matters, and I agree with him that we don't do budgeting in that kind of a cycle, but certainly using the short session as an opportunity to tee up, in some cases, very complex topics for the next long session, allow people a chance to sort of socialize ideas, have folks come in and testify, prepare agencies to respond if necessary, and use that time in that kind of a profitable way. So again, this measure may be one of those things that takes a number of times at bat before it gets any traction, but just as Senator Devlin offered his SJR 6 as a continuation of a conversation, I offer this as the beginning of a conversation to try to restore some degree of discipline to the short session. Thank you for your consideration of SJR 8.
Okay, thank you, Senator Johnson. I know if I had a dollar for every time somebody has said, well, you can always bring your bill back in February, I would have a lot of dollars already. So.
You would, Madam Chair, and if I could opine, I think failing to deal with some of those bills in the preceding long session and then have them rise like zombies and walk among us as the undead and try to do in 5 months what we couldn't do, I mean, 5 weeks what we couldn't do in 5 months, results in errors that are in some cases costly, contradictory, and we find ourselves having to come back and repair damage that was created in haste.
Any questions for Senator Johnson? Okay, I don't see any questions for you, but thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we do have one more person signed up. Do you mind if we take that and then we'll go to your bills? Okay, and I'll call Dave Reinhardt.
Chair, members of the committee, Dave Reinhardt here today, not representing a particular client, but here in my capacity as a citizen and observer of Oregon politics for too many decades now, way too many decades. I'm here because I have really come to believe that has happened over time. The reputation of a legislature is very important as an institution, and it's a very fragile thing. And I think you've seen the popularity of the legislature, the public regard for the legislature go up and down over time. I think further that if there aren't limits placed on the short session, we're going to get into a situation very quickly, if we have not started to enter it already, where the reputation, the stature of the legislature suffers. And that shouldn't happen. I don't think it's good for the process if it does. And I think if you place some limits on it of the kind that Senator Johnson has delineated, you will avoid that. I think also, and I may be committing lobbyist suicide here, that the recommendation proposed proposed by Senator Devlin, if done by itself, would actually make matters worse if you didn't create some limits on the kind of legislation that can be offered. And to his criticism that this would leave a lot of legislators in the building with nothing to do, that is not necessarily a bad thing if they do nothing. I would suggest that they, from my point of view, of course, I would suggest that they could do some things of the kind that Senator Johnson suggested. They might also start overseeing some of the projects and bills that they were so eager to have passed, and see how they're actually working in practice. That would be a healthy thing. I'd urge you to start this conversation. I think it's an important one, and I will say that while I speak alone today on this, I do not think I speak alone for a number of folks in the building, and that I'd just urge your consideration. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions from members? Okay, thank you again. And I'll close the public hearing on SJR 6, close the public hearing on SJR 8. So I will carry over Senate Bill 832A, so if anyone was here for that, you don't need to wait. And next, I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 214, Senate Bill 215, and Senate Bill 217. Members, we did take this up last week, but Senator Roblin is here again because not everybody was here that day. And if you'd like to just...
And I'll try to go through this.
We'll just let Senator Roblin do it. Okay, great.
Thank you, Chair and Rules Committee. For the record, Arne Roblin, Senate District 5. Last week when I was here, I went through these bills, but I think that I hadn't had a cup of coffee to calm down before I got here. So I think I went through it fairly quickly and not as clearly as I should have. And so I want to have an opportunity, and I know that Senator Farioli was not here, so I want to have a quick overview of those three bills. I'll start with Senate Bill 214. 214 really had very little to do with OEIB. There's a part of me that believes that it should, but it was a bill that we had in the committee that would have required school districts to add things to their list of things they had to do if they got money for full-day kindergarten. Most of us in our committee didn't think that was a good idea. Full-day kindergarten should get their money to do full-day kindergarten. We should have a conversation about the others. So talk to the governor's office. They said we would love to have that bill available to do some amendments. So when we sent all three of the bills to the Rules Committee, they were working on those amendments. If you look at Senate Bill 214 right now, what it really does is it takes one of the strategic investments that the OEIB had put forward in 2013, that one having to do with grade 3 reading initiative, and basically put the whole framework in place. So what this does is implement that whole plan. It implements early literacy through third grade reading, so that all kids by the time they're in third grade will be reading at grade level. And it lists all the different conditions. Because of the relating clause and because of the way it's written, it gives all of the authority to the Department of Ed. And in the intermeeting year from 2013 to then, the early learning has been put kind of as a part of, in its own way, the Department of Ed. So it gives them the authority to make grants and to work with relationships with school districts to implement this program. And it lays out all of the criteria you have to do to do that, including that you have to have an agreement with at least two in the bill, community-based organizations. And so and then they would pass money through to those community-based education institutions so that they can help with early literacy. with the idea that kids will come ready to go to kindergarten and from kindergarten be ready by third grade to be reading at grade level. That's the purpose of it. It needs to go to Ways and Means because it only works if it's funded. And so Ways and Means still has the conversation now that it's been fleshed out if they're going to go ahead and implement that. I'm going to skip to 217 because that one is about strategic investments that were made in 2013 that OEIB has set in place. And if you think about what they are, that was the Oregon Early Reading Program, which, as I said, is pretty much the implementation of that is in 214. The Guidance Support and Post-Secondary Aspirations Program. So that has to do with how do we get kids from the current place to graduation. And then connecting the world of work and work programs. So that takes us into the community college. Those three were the main strategic investments that they talked about. It also does some things to adjust OEIB's role with respect to strategic investments to be consistent with Senate Bill 215, which we're going to go back to. It starts that OEIB shall identify and make recommendations to the Legislative Assembly about programs that make strategic investments rather than design and implement. So what it's saying is we're going to work together with the community colleges, the universities, the K-12, and early childhood to come up with recommendations that they think should be funded in the future. They also put in there ways to increase the number of students who receive free lunch, reduce the rates of chronic absenteeism among historically underserved students, and increase the number of students who receive general education development, GED, certificates. Each of these is about getting more people to graduate. It is about what OEIB was about. It was about moving the seamless system and making it work. And again, this goes to Ways and Means because it only works if it gets funded. And so this gives them the framework on which of those programs they want to fund, and then the people in Ways and Means can decide which ones they have resources to fund. That takes us back to Senate Bill 215, which was the one that we spent the most time in our work group about. And it does a number of things. The measure discontinues the OEIB board. It goes away. It extends the sunset on the OEIB organization that's left, which is, will be just an agency, to 2019, and changes the name of the agency to the Chief Education Office. So basically it would be an office in which we do a few of the things that it's already been designed to do. As we've talked about, the STEM hubs, the other bill that we didn't talk about that's already been through, which is the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning. It develops the rules and does those issues. And it will become primarily an agency that works at, as we said in 217, coordinating and collaborating with the other parts of the education institution to make a seamless program for students in Oregon. It also modifies the purpose for which monies may be distributed for the strategic investment programs mentioned above, I went to 217. It also, the office is charged primarily with coordinating with education stakeholders to establish a unified public education system that eliminates the systemic barriers and provides education equity and meets the state's educational goals. We also put into the whole education enterprise TSPC and put them into that group so that this new agency will be coordinating the efforts of not only K-12, early childhood, Youth Investment Board, and the HEC, but also TSPC. We have a bunch of work left to do in that bill, and one of the things we've talked about is we will continue the work group that started with the 20-some people that I gave you the list of last organizations to continue working through the interim to come up with more legislation for the next session to try to continue to coordinate the education system, make it more efficient, and hopefully work at the same purposes along the line. So that's kind of a more succinct conversation of what I said last time. And I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you for that overview. Did we have any questions, Senator Farriola?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for having only one installment.
Well, thank you.
I missed the other meeting. So I'm trying to play catch up here. when I look at the summary my staff's prepared, it's clear that the early reading program starts at age 3.
Correct.
And goes through 3rd grade, and the objective, of course, is to prepare students to be at grade level as soon as possible, but certainly by grade 3.
Correct.
In District 30, where the distance between three-year-olds might be measured in miles or even in hours.
Yes, that's right.
What's the delivery mechanism for students that are 3 years old, not in kindergarten, not in anything necessarily programmatic? They're home. How do we get those 3-year-olds involved? What's the mechanism of outreach?
We have throughout the regions now, and my hub just got selected, these hubs that we developed for early education hubs. There were 2 left that hadn't been given status as a regional hub. One was down in the South Coast where I was at. They just got approved, I understand. And another one was up on the Columbia Gorge area. Your area has had some. They've had groups that have been getting together to develop the hubs. And within that section, one of the things that they're supposed to do is identify kids who need extra help and then figure out what community-based organizations are in the areas long distances apart, who can provide some of that stuff, early literacy, if they need to have opportunities to get books to their home so the parents can they train the parents to read to their kids? Because early literacy is not as much about sitting them in a classroom. It's about giving them opportunities that get them ready for school. So how do I sit and read a book? How do I hold a book? Do I turn it upside down or right side up? Do I have a language developed? Am I having enough words spoken in the family? Do I do those kinds of things? And there are ways in which you can do that by giving information directly. You've got some of the hubs are working with their community care organizations to make sure that there are books available in every one of the physicians' offices that they give the kids and the families when they come in and sit down and say, here's one of the things you can do to help your children by reading this book to them every night or getting some other books and having opportunities to get them engaged in the understanding that when I look at a book and I see these little squiggles underneath it that have no meaning to me, my parent understands those words, and over time, if I'm read to, I start to make connections between the words that are on that page and the words that I'm going to have to learn how to read. So it's those early literacy skills that are important in that 3 years old to the understanding of the rest, and that's
I'm
what
sure
the hubs are about.
Continue. That I understand. What I don't understand is there an assessment for 3 years old? Is there an outreach program? Are folks going door to door? You know, 3-year-olds are not in institutions.
Right. The hubs,
we institutionalize them right. Later.
Actually, we start institutionalizing some of them at your ESDs earlier than that. We have some responsibilities to kids who have learning disabilities and other kinds of chronic illness and stuff to start providing services for them ahead of time. In those conversations, you start to identify other kids that may. Sometimes it's poverty. Sometimes it's that the families don't have any resources to do some of the stuff. And our goal is that the hubs will start developing tools to identify those kids and to figure out how we can help support them with some of that material. And I know that the hubs that I've been engaged with working with trying to get ours set up, that's one of the big things they did was try to make an analysis of who those people are out there and who already has contact with them that isn't the school contact that can put resources in their hands of those families and those other kids. That's how we try to do it. Each of the schools has their own understanding of who the kindergarten kids that are coming. So, and some of them are families, so there's ways to develop programs through your kindergarten kid to get other materials back to your younger children. So we're leaving that up, I think, in most parts to the hubs. This bill actually gives them the opportunity to get grants from the regular school districts out to those other community organizations that they believe can be the ones that help deliver that system to them.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any other questions for you, Senator Roblin. So
the question is, we have to fund it, because that's why it's going to waste means.
Right, for sure. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming back.
On another bill,
sure.
Senator
Ferriola.
On 216, you had to put ESPC in it, didn't you? You just had to put ESPC.
I will tell you that was the easiest part of the whole meeting. When it was mentioned, every single person in the group said, that would be really a good idea. We were hoping and maybe having the conversation to carry over until the next session, into the next bills. But the feeling was getting them engaged with the other agencies that need to be working with them. We heard today in our Subcommittee on Ways and Means of the new certificates they're trying to develop. We want to make sure that we have opportunities through TSBC to get the STEM teachers and other people certified and ready to go, so we have opportunities, because right now we have a lack of some of those people. And we believe that by having them involved with the other agencies more, having those collaborations and opportunities to talk things, it can make that agency work better as well.
And Madam Chair, is there a firm assurances that TSB won't need a dozen new FTE?
I think they're feeling pretty comfortable that they have a bill in that we're looking at right now to make sure that they have enough people to do the job that we've entrusted them with. But I would say that most people feel that they need to be as frugal as they can to do the work that they need to do, and we need to watch that that's happening.
And someday, Madam Chair, if I live long enough, somebody will explain what that job is at TSBC.
Anyway, if I have some time, there's a lot of things they do that are really important to schools, and I would love to sit down and have a conversation with you about that.
Welcome.
But licensure and other kinds of things are things that every state in the union has to do with respect to the people who are in classrooms teaching our kids. So I'd be glad to talk to you about that, too.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Thank you, Senator Roblin, for coming back.
Thank you very much.
And I am going to temporarily close the work sessions on Senate Bills 214, 215, and 217, and open a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 15. And Erin, would you just briefly tell us what this is?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 15 declares that the Lobby Message Center in the Oregon State Capitol shall be known as David S. Barrows Lobby Center.
Thank you, Erin. And I do see that the governor has joined us. Are you here to kick off the testimony? Why don't you please come forward? Welcome, Governor Brown. Good to see you back.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, Kate Brown, currently serving as governor of the state of Oregon. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of SCR 15, which, if passed, would name the Lobby Message Center in the Oregon Capitol after David Barrows. Dave Barrows was a friend to many people in this room, and for those of you who never had the privilege of his friendship or collegiality, you missed a truly amazing man whose deep love and respect for the process of making public policy contributed greatly to the professionalism of lobbying in Oregon. If Dave Barrows' religion was public discourse, his creed was statesmanship. He strongly believed that there was a right way and a wrong way to conduct the people's business. The strength of his passion compelled him to write it down and share this important information with newcomers so they'd be sure to get it off on the right foot. In 1991, in fact, I was one of those new folks. As the new lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition, Dave Barrows took me under his wing and showed me the ropes. He gave me a copy of his little red book, The Do's and Don'ts of Lobbying, which I still have, and helped me navigate the unpredictable partisan and bipartisan waters of state politics. Over the course of his many decades working at the Capitol, I know Dave held himself to a high standard in terms of professional conduct, and he expected others to do the same. It is fitting that the Lobby Message Center bear his name as a reminder of those high standards and his many contributions to the public process. I am pleased to have this opportunity to honor Dave Barrows and the Barrows family in this way, and I appreciate your consideration of SCR 15 as a way to achieve that. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Governor Brown. Seems very appropriate for you to be here and starting our testimony today. Did we have any questions? I don't see any questions, so thank you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know his wife, Pat, is in the room. I just want to say that both Dave and Pat were very good friends to both Dan and I over the years. They helped us raise our children that we struggled with over time, and we just really appreciated their friendship and their support over the past couple of decades.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again. And next I'll call, we have three people signed up to testify, so I will call Congresswoman Darlene Hooley, Former Senator Margaret Carter and Lynn Parton, if the three of you want to come forward. We have three chairs. Good afternoon to all of you, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you for putting, yes, the Kleenex closer. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm here to just say a few words about Dave, who was, for me, a mentor and a friend. And he was always...
Congresswoman, if you could just say your name for the
I'm
record.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Darlene Hooley, for the record. Dave was the kind of person that when I first met him, and it was interesting when I decided to run for the Oregon legislature, people said, oh, you've got to meet Dave. And I met with Dave. I didn't know enough to ask him for money, but I didn't know that people respected him. And he gave me, I spent 2 hours talking to him, and he gave me great advice that I actually followed. And as a member of this body, he was always in my office talking about the bills he was supporting. But the thing that I appreciated, he always gave the opposing side. I said, what's the other side doing? And I said, am I going to hear that same message from when they come in and testify or come in and see me? And he was always just dead on in his what the opposition was going to say and what he wanted. And, you know, we didn't always agree on all of his issues, but he was a person of great integrity. And I want to talk about two other things with Dave. One is it gave me, it was one of those times that I just loved and wouldn't miss. And that was when Dave and Pat would take a group of women to Seattle. Some of us liked to watch the football game, but most of we were there to shop. And whoever was in a new office, whether it was Vera Katz or Margaret Carter or anybody else, we made sure that we all decided what clothes they were going to buy. And in this trip, we were in a van. We all paid for everything. We laughed for 4 hours on the way to Seattle, and we laughed every night at dinner. And we laughed for 4 hours coming home. And those were really treasured moments. And also we did a little poll about who was going to win and who was going to run and all that kind of stuff. We couldn't get away from politics totally. The other thing that I want to talk about is 6 days before he died, I had the privilege of having breakfast with Dave and Pat and Margaret. And again, it was a lot of reminiscing about the legislature, about some of the trips. We spent a lot of time laughing, talking about what he was going to do. And I have missed him terribly and will continue to miss him. And I am just delighted that you're honoring him in this way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Margaret Carter, retired state senator in Northeast Portland. I am very pleased to be able to testify about Dave Barrows, the man. He was a person of very high integrity and was responsible for my being here in the legislature. Everybody was quite surprised that all of these white male Republicans were getting Margaret Carter to run as an urban Democrat for the legislature. And it has been a true love ever since that day that had the privilege of knowing Dave and Pat and seeing Tom run around and grow up to be a man that is here today walking in the footsteps of his father with the same kind of integrity. So it's my pleasure to be able to talk about this person who was, in my view, the true expression of what it was to be a very concerned citizen about our state, our people, and the history of this great building in which we all sit. Dave had great respect and paid honor always to being here, being a member of the lobby, and being able to make a difference in policy in the state, and I enjoyed that. I share Congresswoman Hooley's expressions about Dave always letting you know the side he was on and what the other side would say. He was never, ever untruthful about that, and never one time did he compromise his own political beliefs in order to lie to you about what the other side would say, or something of that nature. He was certainly a high person. He was in high standards with me as a person of this state. And he also exemplified in every way what it was like to love and respect all human beings. When I first came to the legislature, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, there were no black people from North Northeast Portland in this body. And he would tell me all about it, and he would say, now, we don't want you to run and not be reflective of your district. We just want to make sure that we have access and that the people of the state have access to know what is going on in North Northeast Portland and that we can be supportive of that. He never asked you to compromise your principles for him or for his position or his view on a particular issue. And so there was no way that Dave Barrows does not belong in the annals of history in our great state, because he has made a great contribution. He also was one of the members of the Alliance for Economic Development who said, let's look at the landscape and let's see who's not there. And that was another one of the reasons that I was able to come here and be supported by him. And he wrote all the women organizations across the state and introducing me to people, profiling me and everything else. He wasn't just a person that started with you. He ended up until the goal was accomplished. And so, in that sense, I appreciate the fact and think it's very befitting that this contribution is made to Dave in terms of the Message Center, and that we look in terms of the preservation of history that Dave presented in his lifetime in this building. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate very, very much your contributions to this effort, and hope to see SCR 15 pass by both members of this chamber. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For the record, my name is Lynn Parton. I've known Dave also a long time, and I'm very much in favor of this bill, partly because I'm a member of the Capital Club, and I can't wait to see his name up there constantly, wherever we wind up, and we don't know yet. But I have to apologize in advance because a couple of things are sort of marginal. I also have some serious ones, so. Back in the day, before Senate Bill 10, there used to be gatherings every month that Bob Shipriak would get together at Magoo's, and they were called Practice Sunny Dies. And at one of them, Ted Hughes was sitting here, and Dave Barrows was sitting here, and I was sitting here, and the whole, you know, table is filled out, rooms filled out. We're trying to figure out who's been in the building longer. And I said to Dave, I said, I can remember exactly how long you've been here because it's exactly the same amount of time as I've been alive. And he took his middle finger and he shoved his glasses up his nose like that. So he definitely had, you know, the sense of humor about these things. On a more serious note, when I ran for the legislature, he did not just have one of his clients cut me a check. He took me to lunch and gave me a bunch of advice and the check. And similarly, when I became a private lobbyist, I went to ask him for advice on billing, like how much and how, like hourly or, you know, how to do it and how much to do, and he gave me that kind of advice too. I mean, it was like every aspect of what goes on in the building you know, Dave was happy to hear about. Also, I'm a board member of NARAL, and Dave was one of the last really, really pro-choice Republicans. And he was, there were limitations on how long board members were supposed to serve, but he was there for way past that. And I'm not even sure exactly how long it was, but he was involved in a lot of what I perceived to be good stuff. Okay, so here's another story about before Senate Bill 10. People used to have parties during session, and I was no exception. And I've rented a room from time to time from a friend in Kaiser, Becky Hone, now Thorson, and she has a built-in swimming pool. So we got some little radio-controlled boats, and we named them after weird bills, like the feral pig was one of them, and Elvis was another. And so we thought people would race them across the pool. Well, what happened with Dave was not that. Dave and Speaker Larry Campbell were ramming the boats as hard as they could. One of them rammed the other so hard it popped it up over the lip of the pool and into the jacuzzi. So they were being kind of rowdy with these little toy boats. On back to more serious, the book I also have a copy of still, and at one point I had a bunch of copies. I worked at Oregon Housing and Community Services Department for 15 years, and most of that time I was a registered lobbyist for them, so they wanted me to put together like kind of a little class about lobbying the legislature. So I got together with Dave, and he got me the requisite number of copies of his book. And it's my belief, giving credit where credit is due, that Pat Barrows did a lot of the background work on that. I think she was very involved with it too. And it's a fabulous, Dave's little red book, I call it, but I think it's perfect to name the Lobby Message Center after Dave. And I figured there would be some kind of a, you know, memorial thing. But when I saw specifically what this was, I was really glad. So please pass it.
Okay, thank you all for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, thank you again.
Thank you, Manager.
And just as really hard to even think of anything more to say, but to Tom and to Pat in particular, you know, so much of an outpouring of love and respect, I think, for Dave has just been there. I know that you've probably been surrounded by it and felt it, but I always think, and the word that keeps coming up, I mean, he's referred to as the dean of the lobby and so much a part of the fabric of this building, and the word integrity keeps coming up again and again. But I always think that people don't talk enough about his just passion and love for the arts and food and key lime pie and the finer things in life too, because he had so much joy and just love of living and was just such a vital person. Those are the things that I remember along with his integrity and his good work, and we think of him all the time around here, and certainly with this very fitting tribute, he will be forever in our hearts and a part of this place. So thank you. So that completes our testimony, so I'll close the work session, close the public hearing and open a work session. Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move SCR 15 to the floor with the be adopted recommendation.
Senator Ferrioli has moved Senate Concurrent Resolution 15 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion, Senator Beyer?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I can't think of a more fitting tribute and a better named place on the Lobby Center. Dave was the key figure in lobbying in this building. And I think you heard it a lot from others, but I too thought of Dave when I started here as my mentor. And I suspect that every freshman legislator had Dave as their mentor. And regardless of which party you're in, Dave was always most interested in seeing that you as an individual were successful in representing your district. And he was outstanding at it. I often, even when I had been here quite a while, would corner Dave and ask him what he thought about bills that he didn't have a client for, because I really trusted and valued his advice. And I miss that. I really miss that this time. So this is a wonderful tribute, and I'm glad we can do it.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Okay, and any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, any objection to the motion? Okay, the motion carries. And looks like Senators Courtney and Farioli are the chief sponsors, so how about if we ask them to be co-carriers on the floor? And that's what we'll do. And I'll close the work session on SCR 15. And I'll reopen the work sessions on Senate Bill 214, 215, and 217. And we, I think, have had our explanation of these bills. So let's just...
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, just for the record, on Senate Bill 214, you have the Dash 5 amendment. The Dash 5 amendment does replace the underlying measure. With the adoption of the Dash 5 amendment, the measure would need to go to Ways and Means, as there have been, and there will be fiscal and revenue impacts for this measure.
Okay, and they're all ready to move them.
They are, Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 214.
Okay, Senator Farioli moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 214. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay, amendment is adopted. Senator Farioli.
And Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 214 with a due pass as amended recommendation to a Ways and Means, Madam Chair, to be referred to Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator Farioli moves Senate Bill 214 as amended with a due pass recommendation to Ways and Means, and be referred to Ways and Means. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Bill moves to Ways and Means. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 214. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Senate Bill 215, you have the Dash 3 amendment, has been discussed before you today, and on the 21st, the Dash 3 amendment 2 replaces the underlying measure. And with this measure, it can and be referred to the floor. A statement was issued indicating that the cost of this measure has already been accounted for in the governor's budget, and the overall impact is minimal. So this measure will be going to the floor with the adoption of the Dash 3.
Okay, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 215.
Senator Farioli has moved to adopt the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 215. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 215 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved Senate Bill 215 with a due pass as amended recommendation to the floor. Okay. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. This is going to the floor, and Senator Roblin has left us, but I think we'll just ask him to be our carrier on the floor, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 215. And Erin?
And Madam Chair, for the record, Senate Bill 217, we will be considering the Dash 2 amendment today. 2 replaces the underlying measure. As indicated in previous testimony, this measure does need to go to Ways and Means as well with the adoption of the Dash 2 amendment.
Okay, Senator Farioli?
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 217.
Senator Farioli has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 217. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Motion carries. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 217 as amended with a due pass recommendation and to be referred to Ways and Means.
Senator Farioli has moved Senate Bill 217 with I do pass as amended recommendation and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 217. And I believe that completes our work for today, members. Thank you. And we are adjourned.